You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey everyone, thanks for downloading the 78th episode of our Civil War podcast. My name is Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all, welcome to the podcast. In the last episode, as y'all will recall, Rich and I started to talk about what happened on the Sea Islands in the aftermath of the Union victory down in South Carolina at Port Royal Sound. This week, we'll continue with that discussion, talking about the Port Royal experiment, which many people viewed as a dress rehearsal for Reconstruction.
As we said last time, after the Battle of Port Royal Sound in November 1861, the hasty departure of almost every local white inhabitant from South Carolina's Sea Islands left the victorious Federals with the immediate problem of what to do with the 10,000 slaves who remained behind after the whites had fled. And, of perhaps more importance in the eyes of some, what to do with the thousands of acres of cotton fields that stood abandoned. The newly liberated Sea Island slaves soon realized that, although they were no longer under the control of their former owners, they were now caught up in a new and uncertain situation in which they were neither slaves nor freemen, as into the power vacuum created by the departure of their former masters rushed an influx of military officers, treasury officials, northern financiers, school teachers, missionaries, and do-gooders of all stripes, all intent on either aiding the blacks or exploiting them.
Many of the northerners who went south to the Sea Islands had the best of intentions. They were abolitionists who wished to help the liberated slaves make the most of their deliverance from bondage. They wished to educate and train the blacks to take up, quote, all the privileges of citizenship, end quote, which was the ultimate goal envisioned by Edward Pierce, who was Treasury Secretary Salmon Chase's protege and man on the ground there on the Sea Islands. But then other Northerners saw nothing but dollar signs in the situation. They were focused on the cotton fields, some of the most profitable in the South, which now stood abandoned. And besides acquiring the land, these investors were intent on exploiting the proven ability of the former slaves to plant and harvest the very valuable Sea Island cotton.
Really, on the Sea Islands, one of the areas of the South occupied earliest by the Union military, the federal authorities found that the victory at Port Royal Sound had created a political, social, and economic vacuum. And during the Port Royal experiment, as competing interests, some noble, some mercenary, moved to fill that vacuum, and as the former slaves made the transition from bondage to freedom, differences emerged and issues were debated that offered a preview of the conflicts that would shape post-war Reconstruction.
As we mentioned last time, when the white inhabitants of the Sea Islands fled the Yankee invaders, they abandoned the 1861 cotton crop, which had been harvested but not yet ginned and baled. The Sea Island cotton was the fine, long staple cotton that was especially valuable. To northern businessmen who were acutely conscious that the Civil War would mean shortages of raw material for the New England textile mills, the sudden availability of a large supply of fine, long staple cotton after the Port Royal invasion proved an irresistible lure. They knew that there would be exceptionally high returns on that cotton crop if they could acquire it, and beyond that, the continued presence on the Sea Islands of the former slaves who had cultivated and harvested the cotton represented an exceptional opportunity for those willing to seize it. After the 1861 crop had been shipped north, if the businessmen could acquire title to the abandoned plantations and set the former slaves to work cultivating and harvesting the cotton fields, then immense profits might be realized.
And it seemed things were moving in precisely that direction immediately after the Union victory at Port Royal Sound. After the victory, Brigadier General Thomas W. Sherman had appointed a number of cotton agents to supervise the collection and sale of the 1861 crop. but President Lincoln had actually placed the Treasury Department in charge of such abandoned property as might fall into the hands of the Union forces in the South. And so that the Army could hand the business off to the Treasury, Salmon Chase, Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury, appointed William Reynolds as the agent to oversee the disposition of the cotton under a system of free labor.
Free labor as opposed to slave labor. Free labor means you are free to choose the job you want and free to leave that job if you no longer wish to work there.
Right. Anyway, Reynolds was actually recommended to Chase by Rhode Island Governor William Sprague, whose wealthy family was involved in the textile business. So you can read into Sprague's recommendation of Reynolds whatever you choose. But anyway, Reynolds arrived at the town of Beaufort in December 1861.
And thanks to listener Bill C. for letting us know that in South Carolina, B-E-A-U-F-O-R-T is pronounced Beaufort.
Right. So, after Reynolds arrived in Beaufort, he promptly extended the system already put in place by General Sherman, whereby cotton agents working for generous fees collected the 1861 crop, paying the former slaves $1 for every 400 pounds of cotton delivered to steamboat landings. The agents also supplied the blacks with clothing and provisions charged against their earnings. The government received a commission of 5% on the abandoned property the agents sent north, which came to include not only cotton, but also such items as household furnishings liberated from the abandoned plantation houses.
To abolitionist-minded Northerners, however, the prospects for setting up a lucrative cotton harvesting business on the Sea Islands were much less interesting than the fact that the Union victory at Port Royal Sound had brought a large African-American community under the protection of the Stars and Stripes. The former slaves of the Sea Islands occupied a precarious position now that their masters had fled, an uncertain position somewhere between slavery and freedom. In fact, anti-slavery Northerners were disturbed when they learned of Reynolds' actions, since they feared the likelihood that charging the blacks sustenance against their meager earnings would lock them into a new kind of bondage under Union auspices.
Salmon Chase, who was the member of Lincoln's cabinet most sympathetic to emancipation, quickly came to realize the anti-slavery and humanitarian dimensions of the Sea Island situation. And so, hard on the heels of Reynolds' arrival in South Carolina, Chase also sent another emissary, Edward L. Pierce. Pierce was a Boston attorney, an abolitionist, who had already served in the Union Army under Benjamin Butler, advocating that the contrabands at Fort Monroe on the peninsula be allowed to work for the federal war effort for wages and be enlisted as soldiers in the Union Army, by which means Pierce said the former slaves could earn, quote, a title to American citizenship and become heir to all the immunities of the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution of the United States, end quote. When he arrived in the Sea Islands, Pierce clashed with Reynolds, since Pierce believed that the blacks should labor under the supervision of superintendents who were concerned less with profits than with humanity, and with assisting the former bondspeople make the transition from slavery to full freedom. Chase endorsed Pierce's scheme, and in mid-February 1862, Abraham Lincoln, although still concerned about the effect upon the border states of any gesture toward emancipation, the president told Chase and Pierce to go ahead with their plan.
In his book, A Great Civil War, A Military and Political History, 1861 to 1865, Russell Weigley writes that, quote, Pierce's plan also included private action by humanitarian groups to send teachers among the Sea Island blacks to prepare them for citizenship in ways that labor alone, however increasingly self-reliant and independent, could not, by teaching them reading, writing, and Northern moral and patriotic ideals, end quote. Pierce's efforts to recruit teachers, missionaries, and superintendents and find financial support for them bore fruit among New England anti-slavery circles. He likewise found backing for his project in the more moralistic and evangelical reform circles of New York City, and a veteran abolitionist group in Philadelphia also joined the movement. The Boston, New York, and Philadelphia groups formed an alliance known as the Port Royal Relief Committee.
As the teachers and missionaries arrived in South Carolina in March 1862, Pierce saw to their placement on the Sea Islands, and friction soon developed between their humanitarian efforts and Reynolds' more profit-oriented activities. The friction was short-lived, though, since Secretary Chase had decided that the cotton agents' work wouldn't extend beyond the collection of the 1861 crop. That meant planting the new crop and reorganizing the agricultural life of the Sea Islands would take place under humanitarian auspices. So in the spring, Reynolds and his agents departed, having earned the contempt of the reformers as money grubbers, while Reynolds and his agents returned the sentiment in spades, viewing the anti-slavery reformers as clueless crusaders who were doing as much harm as good.
The plans laid in Washington in the spring of 1862 included eliminating possible conflict between the Treasury Department and the Union military by turning over the whole administration of the Sea Islands to the War Department. But with the change, there would be no lessening of the humanitarian mission on the islands, since the new Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, was decidedly anti-slavery.
On March 31st, General Sherman was superseded in the local military command, which from mid-March had been styled the Department of the South. Sherman was superseded by Major General David Hunter, who was known to be more sympathetic than Sherman to emancipation. Near the end of April, Brigadier General Rufus Saxton, who had been unusual among pre-war Army officers in his anti-slavery views, he became Hunter's deputy in charge of land and labor. Secretary of War Stanton ordered Saxton to, quote, take possession of all the plantations heretofore occupied by the rebels, and take charge of the inhabitants remaining thereon within the department, or which the fortunes of war hereafter bring into it, end quote. And so, under Stanton's authority, Saxton operated the Sea Island plantations in accord with Edward Pierce's design, although Pierce himself felt obliged to return to his own affairs in Boston. And, just as an aside, but when the war was over, Saxton's experience with the former Sea Island slaves led to his appointment as a Freedmen's Bureau commissioner in the area.
The Sea Islands project was coming to be known as the Port Royal Experiment, and it was indeed an experiment, since at this time in the war there didn't exist a government blueprint regarding the former slaves' transition to freedom. In the first half of 1862, Abraham Lincoln's own views on how to present the necessity of emancipation as a war aim were evolving, and so his administration's policies when the Port Royal experiment began offered little in the way of clear-cut governmental commitment regarding the former Sea Island slaves' future. This meant that their transition from slavery to freedom was bound to often be a disorienting experience for them.
Throughout 1862, no one on the Sea Islands, not the former slaves, and not the Northerners who intended to help them transition from slavery to freedom, no one could yet be certain where the experiment was leading. But in the meantime, besides instilling in the blacks the Yankee values associated with self-reliant motivation, the teachers and missionaries sought to persuade the former slaves to resume planting and caring for the cotton crop. But before the war, the slaves on the Sea Islands had been largely organized on the task system of labor, in which they were assigned daily to mostly unsupervised jobs, the completion of which left them free to cultivate their own crops on small plots and market the crops in nearby settlements. And so with that experience as part of their past, many of the former Sea Island slaves now wanted nothing to do with planting cotton for white folks again, but they instead wished to grow food for their families and for sale, wished to grow it on their own land without white supervision.
When the white planters fled their plantations after the Union victory at Port Royal Sound, slaves had destroyed the cotton gins, which they viewed as symbols of their oppression, and many of them commenced planting food crops on the same land they had toiled on in their bondage. The former slaves insisted that the government should assist them in obtaining title to the land they had worked for generations, and which they thought had become, in effect, family plots. Many Northern reformers, however, believed that the transition from bondage to freedom meant not giving the blacks land, but supervising them as they worked for wages in more humane conditions than under slavery. In fact, it was an article of faith in Northern anti-slavery circles that with emancipation, freed blacks would become more productive cotton laborers than slaves. As Rich mentioned, though, the former slaves themselves wished to grow food for their families and for sale, rather than cultivate and harvest cotton again under white supervision.
But during the war, while some black families did manage to acquire land at auctions organized by the Treasury Department or by private owners, and others simply became squatters on abandoned plantations, most of the Sea Island land went to Northern investors who were bent on demonstrating the superiority of free labor and, of course, turning a tidy profit at the same time. For example, in September 1863 and again in December, the president directed that plots of land in the Sea Islands be set aside for sale to black families at a price of $1.25 an acre to give them, quote, an interest in the soil, end quote. But Northern businessmen brought immense pressure to bear and persuaded Treasury Secretary Chase, who oversaw the land sales, to amend the instructions. And so when the auction actually took place in February 1864, some black families acquired farms, but most of the land ended up in the hands of army officers and Northern investors.
Under such circumstances, it would really be little wonder if many of the former Sea Island slaves questioned whether they had simply experienced the replacing of one set of white masters for another set of white masters. Indeed, Russell Wigley, in A Great Civil War, notes that in many spots on the islands, quote, the old gang system of plantation labor persisted, albeit under Northerners' direction. The tension between hoping to encourage self-reliance and the humanitarians' paternalistic methods of doing it underlay all activities. The African Americans, while usually ostentatiously friendly to their new masters and aware that the currents of time were carrying them toward freedom, despite eddies along the way, also maintained a shrewd and healthy skepticism about the motives animating their new set of white masters. End quote.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As you guys will recall, back in episode number 69, Tracy and I talked about how in August 1861, out in St. Louis, in the Department of the West, General John C. Fremont had gone a bit rogue and issued a proclamation freeing the slaves of Missouri rebels. But Abraham Lincoln, annoyed that Fremont had usurped such authority and fearful that emancipation would drive Kentucky into the Confederacy, he quickly rescinded Fremont's edict. And then in December 1861, then-Secretary of War Simon Cameron incorporated a call for the enlistment of black soldiers into his annual report. This proposal by Cameron was another unilateral scheme unsanctioned by Lincoln, and it too was squelched by the president. The Fremont and Cameron matters displeased Lincoln. At that point in time in the conflict, the president was concerned their actions might jeopardize border state and northern conservative support for the war. In a letter to a Kentucky newspaper editor, Lincoln explained his side of the story, writing, quote, "When, early in the war, General Fremont attempted military emancipation, I forbade it, because I did not think it an indispensable necessity. When, a little later on, General Cameron, then Secretary of War, suggested the arming of blacks, I objected, because I did not yet think it an indispensable necessity." End quote.
In that letter, Lincoln refers to the then Secretary of War as General because in 1829, Simon Cameron was appointed Adjutant General of the State Militia by Pennsylvania's governor, his sister-in-law's brother. Though he served just 2 years, he was known as General for the rest of his life.
Right. Well, anyway, the Fremont and Cameron affairs displeased Lincoln, and then he was further exasperated by another incident that occurred in May 1862 and that grabbed national headlines. We said a bit earlier that Major General David Hunter had replaced Thomas West Sherman as commander of the Department of the South. Well, on May 9th, Hunter unilaterally proclaimed slaves in sections of coastal South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida free, and ordered the enlistment as soldiers of all physically fit black men between the ages of 18 and 45.
A week after Hunter's proclamation, Carl Schurz, the influential German-American Republican and a recently appointed brigadier general in the Union Army, advised Lincoln to respond to Hunter's decree carefully. Schurz said that emancipation was inevitable and in this instance could be rationalized as resulting from, quote, local military necessity, end quote. But the president ignored Church's advice, and on May 19th, he annulled Hunter's emancipation decree. Lincoln remained silent, however, about the general's recruitment of blacks.
In his book, Lincoln and the U.S. Colored Troops, John David Smith explains, quote, "Lincoln overruled Hunter, unconvinced that emancipating African Americans was yet a necessity. Significantly, in revoking Hunter's proclamation, Lincoln made clear that no military commander had the constitutional authority to free and arm slaves. Only the president held these powers. Lincoln could not allow the overly zealous Hunter to proceed with his emancipation plan at the very moment that the president was developing his own program of gradual emancipation and colonization for the border slave states. So without fanfare, and probably as a test case, Lincoln repudiated Hunter's emancipation decree, but silently allowed him to recruit blacks in South Carolina." End quote.
Abraham Lincoln's plan, the one just mentioned in that passage, the plan the president presented to the border states in 1862, was a scheme that called for gradual, compensated emancipation and for colonization of the freed blacks outside the United States. But it fell through when none of the border states would agree to it. But all of that's a story for another episode.
Yeah, we'll probably talk about it later on in the podcast when we look at the background to the Emancipation Proclamation. But anyway, to get back to South Carolina, unfortunately for the Sea Island blacks, Hunter's recruitment actually turned into impressment. That is, Hunter began forcibly conscripting, seizing, and enlisting into the army black men on the Sea Islands. Hunter apparently wanted to demonstrate that the former slaves would make good soldiers, and he believed that black men who fought for the Union could scarcely be re-enslaved at some later time. But none of that excuses how he enforced his enlistment order. In May 1862, as white soldiers on the Sea Islands began to carry out Hunter's orders, seizing former slaves and forcibly coercing them into military units, one observer noted that it created, quote, "the loudest lamentations," end quote, and a, quote, "agony of separation," end quote, as the blacks found that the federal government, in making them soldiers, was separating them from their kin, much as the slave auction block had torn apart their families. Hunter tried to ease the anguish by giving each impressed man a half dollar and a plug of tobacco.
500 men were seized and gathered on Hilton Head Island, where white officers began to instruct them and drill them and transform them into a military unit. Protests from teachers and missionaries of the Port Royal experiment persuaded Hunter to return a few plowmen and foremen who were essential to operating the plantations. The rest, though, remained, and over the next few months, Hunter used the troops of his new unit mostly for guard duty, but also for occasional raiding.
But as news of Hunter's black soldiers reached the north, the inevitable wave of criticism arose from the border states and from northern conservatives. And in August 1862, when Secretary of War Stanton refused to recognize or pay Hunter's black recruits, the general had no choice but to disband all but one company of his black troops, which remained on duty on St. Simon's Island.
Throughout the war, there were simply too many competing interests at play on the newly liberated Sea Islands for the former slaves' transition from bondage to freedom to be an easy one. Nevertheless, for the slaves who lived on the Sea Islands, the Union's military victory at Port Royal Sound gave them the opportunity to take their first step toward freedom. In fact, the Lincoln administration more or less granted them freedom, but really, the fact was that their legal status remained unclear. Despite his own personal anti-slavery views, President Lincoln wasn't prepared to emancipate them. He realized he couldn't simply wave a magic wand and make slavery go away. He knew he still needed to persuade a North, whose basic racial attitudes were usually little better than bigotry, that they were going to have to accept the necessity of emancipation as a war aim. And so it wasn't until January 1, 1863, when the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect, that the Sea Island slaves would be truly freed.
While we wanted to show that mistakes were made and injustices took place on the Sea Islands, we should point out that by the end of the war, the Port Royal experiment was widely held to be a success. The former slaves and their new federal overseers did turn the Sea Islands into a profitable source of cotton, though it was nowhere near as productive as in the pre-war era. As we mentioned, many of the blacks had no desire to continue cultivating and harvesting cotton, which they viewed as the slave crop, instead preferring to grow food crops for their own families and for profit. So when the plantation operations didn't prove as profitable as the northern investors expected, many abandoned the project, dividing their land into lots, which they sold to the former slaves. As a result, it's estimated that by 1870, Sea Islanders owned the most land per capita of any blacks in the South.
As Rich just said, we wanted to show that mistakes were made and injustices took place, but it's worth stressing that by the end of the war, the Port Royal experiment was widely held to be a success. Black families were acquiring education, slowly obtaining land, and if not planting their own crops, then working for wages under more humane conditions than under slavery.
At the beginning of last week's episode, we mentioned Sam Mitchell, who was that young slave who thought the roar of Yankee cannon was thunder on November 7, 1861. Well, he was interviewed in the 1930s when he was an old man, and he described what it meant to be free. "What do I think of slavery?" he said. "I think slavery is just a murdering of the people. I think freedom been a great gift. I like my master, and I guess he was as good to his slave as he could be, but I rather be free."
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation, and our recommendation this time is Rehearsal for Reconstruction, The Port Royal Experiment by Willie Lee Rose.
The Port Royal Experiment really deserves better coverage than our poor effort to explain it here on the podcast. So if you guys are interested in delving more deeply into the subject on your own, Willie Lee Rose's book is a good place to start. It's a bit dated. It was published in the 1960s, but it's still the best one-stop spot for those who want to learn more about this fascinating and important Civil War story. So that's Rehearsal for Reconstruction, The Port Royal Experiment by Willie Lee Rose. You can find all of our book recommendations at the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.blogspot.com.
And then as we wrap things up for this show, Rich and I wanted to be sure to thank Bill C. from South Carolina and George C. from Michigan for their donations this past week. Thanks, guys.
And thanks to each of you for listening to this episode of the Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. We hope you'll join us again next time when Tracy and I look at Ulysses S. Grant's life story. But until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.